Welcome to the Federalist Society Practice Group podcast. The following podcast, hosted by the Federalist Society's Administrative Law and Regulation Practice Group, was recorded on Wednesday, August 28, 2013, during a live telephone conference call held exclusively for Federalist Society members. Welcome to the Practice Group telephone conference call. On today's call, we're going to be discussing the RAINS Act and maybe some other measures to give Congress more control and oversight of agency action. I'm Dean Reuter, Vice President and Director of Practice Groups at the Federalist Society. Please note that all expressions of opinion are those of the experts on today's call, and also this call is being recorded for possible use as a podcast in the future. Today we're going to hear from three experts in the field. They're going to make opening remarks, brief opening remarks, after which we're going to have some moderated discussion and then questions from the audience. We'll hear first from the pair of Trevor Foudy, who's the Communications Director in the office of Representative Todd Young, and Emily Mueller, who's the Legislative Director, also in the office of Representative Todd Young. They're going to give us some background and some reasoning for the proposed legislation, about 5 minutes or so. And then we'll hear for maybe 10 to 12 minutes or so from Professor David Schoenbrod, who is the visiting scholar at the American Enterprise Institute and a trustee professor at the New York Law School. And interestingly, he's also the author of a crowdsourcing book called The Honest Deal, which is a look at congressional accountability, including the RAINS Act, but also including issues beyond the RAINS Act. And you can go see the webpage for that book at governmentwithouttricks.org. That's all one word, governmentwithouttricks.org. And you can actually sample parts of that book, I understand. And if you just Google Government Without Tricks, you'll get to that page as well. I've mentioned in the past, we've got the full bios for all our speakers, as typically the case, on our website. So I've been brief in the introductions, but let's turn now to Trevor Foudy and Emily Mueller for their opening remarks. Go right ahead.
Thanks, Dean, and thanks to the Federal Society for putting this together. I want to start, I guess, with a little bit of history here. Currently, Congress has in place a mechanism to disapprove of current regulations called the Congressional Review Act, where a resolution can be introduced in both chambers and we can essentially vote down an existing regulation. In the 15 to 20 years that has been around, though, it's only been used once. So a couple of Congresses ago, Jeff Davis, a member from Kentucky, former member from Kentucky, was looking for a way to address new regulations as they were being introduced and trying to find a way to inject some cost-benefit analysis into the regulatory process. So he developed the RAINS Act, which passed the House last Congress. We didn't see any action in the Senate. It was adopted as part of the RNC platform at the convention in Tampa last August, and it would have been part of the 100 days agenda of Mitt Romney and Paul Ryan had they been elected. This Congress, with Jeff Davis's retirement, they sort of passed the baton on to our office, Todd Young from Indiana's 9th District in southern Indiana. We introduced it as H.R. 367 back in January. It moved its way through the committee process throughout the spring, and then the week before August recess started, we voted on that in the House, where it passed on a vote of 232 to 183, and we picked up 6 Democrat votes. I'm going to turn it over to Emily here shortly to talk about some of the amendments and changes that were made, but I want to talk briefly now about the mechanics of the bill as it was introduced in this Congress. Currently, when a federal agency drafts a proposed rule or regulation, the White House Office of Management and Budget will score the economic impact. If the economic impact is $100 million or more, it's labeled a major regulation. But as far as we can tell, besides that designation, the administration currently does nothing with so-called major regulations. So what the RAINS Act would do would require all designated major rules and regulations to come to Congress for an up or down vote on an expedited timetable. If you look at the numbers over the last decade or so, on average, this would probably add about 50 to 60 votes each Congress, based on what the numbers have been. That's not a whole lot when you consider the number of resolutions that we vote on each Congress to rename post offices or to create specialty coins or stamps. And it's really important for economic purposes. Part of the thinking here, obviously, is that each federal agency, whether it's HHS looking narrowly at healthcare or the IRS looking narrowly at the tax code, tends to work within their jurisdiction and don't look broader to impact on the economy or jobs. So Congress can fill a real role there in doing sort of that cost-benefit analysis. It also would give constituents who are affected more input in the process. There's currently a public comment period for these draft rules and regulations, but that's a little trickier bureaucratic system to work through than it is to talk to your member of Congress. One of the biggest reasons that we've supported this legislation and introduced it is not necessarily an anti-regulation effort, although I think there's an easy case to make for the burden that the number of regulations can have on our economies and job creation. But really, we look at this as more of a congressional accountability measure, and I know that David is going to get into this shortly, but I wanted to touch on it briefly. When you look at where a lot of these rules and regulations come from, it comes from legislation that authorizes executive agencies to draft such rules and regulations. And usually, the bigger ones tend to come from vague, sweeping legislation like Obamacare or Dodd-Frank or any other number of bills that are typically rushed through on a political timetable without much thought given to what the details and logistics of a given law actually look like. Sometimes that's done because of the timetable. Sometimes that's done so that politicians don't have to deal with the tough issues. So one of the benefits we see to having a bill like the RAINS Act in effect is that Congress, knowing that these issues would come back to their doorstep anyways, would take the time to deliberate a little more, to think through some of the nuts and bolts of various laws rather than leaving it up to federal legislators. And then ultimately, when a constituent or a constituent group has a problem with the effect of a regulation, it would allow or it would disallow Congress to point to so-called unelected bureaucrats and sort of punt on dealing with the issue. So that's where we're at with the RAINS Act, and I'm going to turn it over to Emily to get in a little of the details on the amendments that were made. It's a fairly cut-and-dried bill, as I've laid out, but she'll get into a little more of those details now.
Sure, thanks. So we had 6 floor amendments added. I'll just go through the list, I guess. Representative Scalise offered one requiring Congress to approve any regulation that would implement a carbon tax in any sense. So even if it would be below that $100 million threshold, any carbon tax measure would come to Congress for an up or down vote. Then Representative Smith offered an amendment to require approval for all rules coming out of the Affordable Care Act, major or smaller. Rodney Davis had an amendment to include in the definition of what constitutes a major rule any interim final rule issued by the EPA that would have a significant impact on a substantial amount of agriculture entities. So basically, this allows USDA and EPA to kind of keep each other in check, and USDA can determine what would have a significant impact on an EPA regulation and then require congressional approval. Representative Webster offered an amendment which prevents federal agencies from implementing significant policy changes without appropriate congressional review. This is to bring in a lot of these guidance documents and memorandums that we are seeing the administration shift to a little bit, so that it's not a set in stone rule, but they're still requiring the private sector to make a lot of changes just to ensure compliance with these types of guidance documents. Then Pete Sessions offered an amendment similar to one that was adopted last year, which requires the agencies submitting the report on the rule to include an assessment of anticipated job gains or loss as a result of implementation of the rule, and to also specify whether that'll come from the public or private sector. So that'll just give members of Congress a little more data to reflect on as they do this up or down vote on the rule. And then the last one significantly changes the bill a little bit more. This reduces what qualifies as a major rule. It brings that $100 million threshold down to $50 million, simply with the intent to have congressional votes on a lot more of these rules. So those were all adopted on the floor and included in the final bill.
So I guess with that, we'll turn it over to David to talk a little more about the philosophy and legality behind some of this.
Sure. Thank you very much. Thank you for setting this up. My starting point is that when statutes tell agencies to issue substantive regulations, Congress delegates to agencies the power to make the laws that govern society. That means that voters lose the ability to hold those who actually make the law accountable at the ballot box. Yet we learned in high school civics that in our democracy, elected legislators should make the law. Now, in the early decades of the Republic, the Supreme Court said the Constitution bars Congress from delegating the power to make the law. However, the court and Congress slid away from this position over the decades. More recently, I and others have argued that the court should revise the doctrine against delegation. However, the court has answered that the federal government now makes too many laws via regulation for Congress to make them all, and the court is bereft of any particular test that could determine what are the right rules for Congress to make versus what are the right rules that it could delegate to agencies. At this point, Congressman J.D. Hayworth and some members of Congress asked me for suggestions on a legislative response to this delegation problem. I drew upon a proposal by the New Deal's leading light of administrative law, James Landis. As dean of Harvard Law School in 1938, he wrote a book in which he urged that Congress pass a statute forbidding important agency regulations from going into effect unless Congress affirmatively votes to approve them. He wrote, quote, "It is an act of political wisdom to put back upon the shoulders of Congress responsibility for controversial choices." The need for legislators to share in the responsibility, as Landis put it, is much greater today than in 1938. Back then, Congress often would give agencies a pretty free hand in writing regulations. They'd say, in essence, here's a problem, you do something about it. Today, Congress dictates with some great specificity the goals that agencies should achieve. Take, for example, the Affordable Care Act. There, the Congress said to the Independent Payment Advisory Board, control costs without diminishing quality of care. It's a little bit like telling the slaves to make bricks without straw. Howard Dean recently wrote an editorial in the Wall Street Journal saying the Affordable Care Act's rate paying won't work. It just won't happen. This is a way for Congress to claim to achieve two inconsistent goals. Nonetheless, it works for legislators to make these unreasonable demands on agencies because they could claim the credit for holding down costs, but then when the board fails to hold down costs, they could blame the board for that, and they could also blame the board for bad care. Now, I saw this kind of thing unfold as an attorney for the Natural Resources Defense Council back in the 70s. In 1970, Congress passed the Clean Air Act amendments, which said, EPA, protect health from all pollutants by the end of the 1970s. Now, to do that, the agency had to do some pretty draconian things. And when the agency started to do it, Then the same legislators, Democrats and Republicans, said, no, you shouldn't be doing that kind of thing. So the legislators got to claim the credit for protecting health. Then later on, they got to claim credit for protecting their constituents from draconian regulations. Now, this is schizophrenic government. It leads to unpredictability. It ends to results in polarization. And the result is polarized, broken government. And I'll give you an example of the way this kind of thing breaks government. We learned around 1990 that actually you could clean up the air at a much lower cost by switching from command and control regulation to market-based regulation. Now, you'd think that Congress would take this lesson and change all the environmental laws to reflect that lesson. But in fact, Congress has not amended or made any major amendments to the environmental statutes in the last quarter century. Why? Because they'd actually have to take some responsibility in updating the statutes, but all these excessive costs they blame on the agency. Now, think of what RAINS would do to the situation. Once legislators had a vote on the regulations that come out of the agency, then the legislators would be responsible for the costs. Therefore, they'd be interested in updating the statutes to make them more cost-effective. So we got basically a crazy system of government, which comes from the ability of legislators to use delegation to claim credit and shift blame. In any event, based on my recommendation, J.D. Hayworth and other members of Congress introduced a bill based upon the Landis idea. It was called the Congressional Responsibility Act, and it required members of Congress to take responsibility for regulations. However, Congress was not willing to do that. So they passed this thing called the Congressional Review Act, which you heard Trevor say hardly ever gets used. But the Congressional Review Act is it gives members of Congress the option of being responsible, whereas the Congressional Responsibility Act would require members of Congress to be responsible. Well, you could see what they chose. They chose to have the option of not being responsible, and we have a mess. So some years later, Congressman Jeff Davis comes along and reintroduces something like the original Congressional Responsibility Act, but he calls it the Regulations from the Executive in Need of Scrutiny Act. That's what produces the acronym RAINS. The new title is unfair in putting the blame on the executive because the real problem is in Congress. And the new title is unwise because it shifts the focus from pro-accountability, which has broad appeal, to anti-regulation, which has a much narrower appeal. So the new title staked out the low ground instead of assuming the high ground, which the Congressional Responsibility Act was on. Now, Representative Young inherited the bill with its title, but to its credit, he and his staff have made clear that the emphasis here is pro-accountability, and I salute them for doing that. In the next Congress, I hope they rename the bill, and the name that's suggested in an editorial in the Wall Street Journal is the Congressional Accountability Act. That's what we're talking about here, having the elected lawmakers be accountable for the laws. So that's what I'd like to see happen. Now, as to these amendments that have come along, the ones that Emily talked about, lowering the threshold from $100 million to $50 million, that's going to greatly increase the number of regulations that Congress would have to vote on. As it is with the 100 million, there's something like between 50 and about 60 or 70 of them a year if we average over the last decade. And I think it would be important to see how Congress is able to handle that before we greatly increase the number of regulations that Congress votes on. And then we have these other things about agricultural entities and cap and trade and all that, and the Obamacare statute and having special votes on that. Well, these amendments allow legislators who introduce or vote for them to send out press releases claiming they struck a blow against a particular kind of regulation. But they've struck no blow unless the bill passes. And their amendments make the bill much less likely to get enacted by ensuring opposition from anybody who's in favor of those kinds of regulations. By striking oppose through such amendments, oppose in favor of accountability, members of Congress avoid actually having to be responsible for any other regulations, which is terrible. We need a pro-accountability bill to get passed and passed soon.
Very good. This is Dean Reuter again. Let me open the floor to questions from our audience in a moment. We're all going to hear an announcement that will say the floor mode is on. After that, if you have a question for any of our experts, you can push the star button and then the pound button on your telephone. So hold on one moment. So once again, if you have a question for any of our experts, push the star button and then the pound button on your telephone. Before we go to the audience, I want to give Trevor Foudy and Emily Mueller a chance, not so much to respond, but to see if there's anything further they want to say before we turn to our audience.
No, I mean, I think David had it right on. And we both used this number that it's somewhere between 50 or 60 or maybe close to 70 major regulations a year. And I think a part that I would emphasize is with the RAINS Act in place, with the accountability that comes with that, we would anticipate that number to drop. If Congress realizes that we have to address these things in legislation before we delegate that responsibility to an executive agency, and we create less opportunities for the executive agencies to regulate, that should decrease the number of major regulations. So potentially we could be dealing with even less than 50 or 60.
Do you expect the number will go down because I don't want to say the system's being gamed, but maybe the calculations on what is and what isn't a major rule might be adjusted a little bit as that definition takes on additional significance?
Maybe
that's too cynical. I don't know.
No, I understand that, and I think we've thought through that. I think as far as the OMB's calculations go, I'm not exactly sure of the formula that they use to determine that, but I think that would be tough for them to change how they're scoring things. I think what's more likely is executive agencies, try and break regulations into smaller parts. But I think the bigger effect is that Congress doesn't try and punt on some of these tough issues.
Mm-hmm.
Obamacare, I think, is a great example where we're still waiting on regulations to come out. It's sort of the old, the Nancy Pelosi statement about we have to pass the bill to find out what's in it. Well, the way that we view that is we needed to pass it so the regulators could tell us what was in it and how it was going to work. So I think with the RAINS Act in place, that would have forced Congress to deal with some of those issues before it ever got to HHS or IRS or whoever.
I'd add that in terms of the risk of the agency trying to estimate the impact of the regulation to be less than $100 million, its agencies already have an incentive to do that because to the extent they do so, they get less serious review from the Office of Management and Budget. Also, to the extent that agencies do that or try to break one regulation into many pieces, they run some considerable risk because the Act maintains judicial review. So if an agency arbitrarily breaks up a major regulation into pieces, what it could find out is that all the pieces get reversed and they're back at square one, having spent 7 or 8 years getting it through the process. So I think there are some substantial safeguards against that type of risk. And in any event, even if there was such a risk, we're talking about going from basically zero accountability for these regulations to some, and it would make sense to get the sum we know we could get. And I think if we keep trying to fool with this thing to get every regulation in, the excellent is going to defeat the good.
All right. If you have a question for any of our experts, push the star button and then the pound button on your telephone. We have two callers with questions, so let's now turn to our first caller.
Hi, this is Chad from the Mercatus Center. How do you see RAINS in relation to other regulatory reform efforts like retrospective review or increased economic analysis requirements? Do you see RAINS as sort of the major opportunity, or is it sort of one reform opportunity linked with others?
Well, I have an attitude about that. David Chumbrett here. I think retrospective review, in other words, review of regulations that are already on the books, is a great idea. It's unclear to me actually how you make that work. I mean, I have a little bit of familiarity with the bill, but I guess it's Senator King and I can't remember who else that's going to try to do that. I take my hats off to them. I think it's a great objective. But it seems to me it's easier to define what to do with the new regs than the existing ones. But I don't see any inconsistency with moving forward on RAINs. And then at some point together or later on moving forward on the retrospective review. What was the other part of your question?
That was, I think, the crux of.
The analysis part. You know, what about better analysis? Well, you know, I guess my thought about analysis is that analysis comes cheap. It's very cheap for Congress to tell somebody to do an analysis. What's really not so cheap is taking responsibility, and that's what votes require people to do. So I'm not against Sessions' amendment that would require some job analysis. But the real point is to get legislators to vote on these things.
Yeah, and I would add, you know, I think there's still definitely a place for retrospective analysis because you start to run into some possible constitutional issues if you try and apply a RAINs model to regulations that are already on the books, which is why it specifically only addresses new regulations. You know, and as far as some of the additional analysis, I think there's room for that with RAINs as well. You know, as I mentioned in the opening statement, HHS is tasked to focus on healthcare issues, and the IRS is tasked to focus on tax code issues and tax compliance issues, and they're not necessarily going to take that broader look, and I don't know that we want them to go outside of their mandates. So Congress is a great place to bring those in where we can do additional analysis, whether it's fiscal cost or job creation or anything else.
What about the argument that some folks make that there's sort of a choice you have to make here between political accountability and agency expertise and insulation from the political process as a good thing? How do you deal with those arguments?
Go ahead, David.
Yeah, Landis addressed this. What he said in his book was, the agency would continue to be, quote, the technical agent in the initiation of rules of conduct, yet at the same time have the elected lawmakers share in the responsibility for their adoption. Under RAINs, the Congress doesn't get to change the regulation. It gets to vote it up or down. So the agency would have full authority to use its expertise in putting things together, and the legislators would do what legislators are supposed to do, which is to be responsible. Besides that, we know perfectly well that legislators stick their thumbs into and their fingers into what agencies do through the back door, and so it's not exactly as if the agency process is pristine and altogether pure science. We know it's a highly political process. And we know, actually, that I know EPA pretty well. There's a lot of information documenting the idea that a lot of the key decisions are not made by scientists. They're made by lawyers.
Yeah, and I would add, you know, those executive agencies derive their power to use their technical ability from the legislative branch in the first place. We're not passing laws in a vacuum. We do it after deliberation and committee hearings where we bring in both those experts and other outside non-governmental experts. So I think there's still a role here for Congress to play in finalizing some of these rules and regulations before they go into effect and taking ownership of them that doesn't in any way jeopardize that technical expertise.
Now, put the shoe on the other foot. Don Elliott, former general counsel of EPA, current Yale Law School professor, also a lawyer that represents business for a major Washington law firm, he points out in an article that the United States Congress is one of the few legislators in the world that doesn't draw upon experts to design legislation. I mean, yes, it holds hearings and experts come in and talk about the topic, but the actual design of the legislation happens in Congress. Now, why is that? Well, because if the real purpose of the legislation is to for legislators to claim credit and shift blame, who knows better how to do that than legislators? If your purpose, however, is to design the legislation that gets the most bang for the buck, then you want experts involved. And that's why the United States Congress is so different, is because its focus is on using delegation to claim credit and shift blame. So we'd actually get more expertise in at the giddy-up, I think, if we had reins in place, because then legislators would have a personal incentive to have sensible, balanced legislation.
All right, we've got three questions pending. Let's go to our next caller.
Hi. It seems to me there's it's kind of difficult to for an ordinary person to lobby your senators and congressmen because of those web forms they have. But there's an organization called Downsize DC that enables you to use various different programs or crusades that they have to send your letter automatically to those web forms. Simply once you filled in the massive amount of information that your senator requires once, it's always in their database and you can send stuff again. They have a relevant thing called the Write the Laws Act, which is S3361 as part of their program. And I've just taken the blurb from this email that announced this meeting and pasted it into the section below that, and I'm about to send it to my two senators and congressmen, none of whom are likely to do anything about it because the three of them are idiots. But downsizedc.org does make a very good tool for getting your views to these people. Also, could you comment on the SS-361, which is the Write the Laws Act? Is that still pending, or it seems to me it's along these lines?
I don't know that that's something that we're familiar with, but we've got a note here, and we'll look into it. And I'm not. Do you know if there's anything on the House side that goes along with that, or is it just in the Senate right now?
Well, this was introduced by Rand Paul. Let's see.
That's it. By the way, I'm going to interject here real quick. Rand Paul is the Senate sponsor of the RAINS Act.
Yeah.
I neglected to mention that earlier, so I would imagine that this does follow along these lines.
Yeah, I would imagine so, too. I don't see in their write-up, it may be just introduced by him. It may not be in the House at this point.
All right, yeah, that's something that we'll definitely look into, and we can talk to Senator Paul's office about that. I guess the other point that I would make is, if you think it's difficult to weigh in on pending legislation with your legislators now, it's, I think, harder to weigh in with the federal agency during the public comment period on any given rule or regulation. So, in a sense, this would at least bring some of those decisions closer to the people.
Yeah. Well, the federal agencies, so many of them now have been captured by the people they're trying to regulate. And in terms of the experts writing the legislation, certainly the Monsanto Protection Act was written by somebody at Monsanto.
All right, we've got two questions pending. If you'd like to join the queue, again, push the star button and the pound button on your telephone. Let's take another call.
John Rowland, Constitution.org. It seems that if one puts a floor on the applicability of the act as, say, some figures say 100 million, the only effect would be that the agencies would then structure all their regulations to each fall below that threshold, and the effect of this effort would be effectively diverted. There is also a problem that, remember, in the Constitution, Article 1, Section 8, 1, Clause 1, and provides that all legislative power is vested in Congress. Now, that doesn't forbid regulations applicable only to government employees or contractors, but I believe it does forbid all regulations applicable to the rest of us. And it seems that if we're going to be at least going to skirt the Constitution, we need to recognize that that's what we're doing and not pretend that any of this is constitutional.
Well, I don't want to pretend it's constitutional. I wrote a book called Power Without Responsibility, which argued that delegation is unconstitutional, and I submitted a number of briefs to the Supreme Court arguing that delegation is unconstitutional. The problem is the Supreme Court, including Justice Scalia, doesn't buy the argument. And so at that point, you begin to have to think about, well, unless and until they do buy the argument, what are we going to do about it? And that's what produced something, you know, the Congressional Responsibility Act, and now Reins in its current embodiment. I wouldn't say that the risk you pose of agencies trying to lowball the impact of their regulations is non-existent, but I do point out that agencies already have a considerable incentive to lowball the impact of their regulations because they get much stricter review from the Office of Management and Budget if the regulation comes in as a major regulation. Beyond that, existing congressional statutes often dictate the scope of regulations. So, for example, under the Clean Air Act, the EPA has to do national ambient air quality standards. Well, it's given the nature of these things, it's impossible to imagine how they could be divided up into pieces so small that they'd be under $100 million. Beyond that, even if an agency was able to do that, there's a huge risk to the agency because, as I pointed out before, it takes so many years for the regulations to get through the administrative process and the judicial review process, and there's a risk that if they do this kind of thing, that they'll be struck down as an, you know, arbitrary and capricious dividing up of something of one regulation into many pieces. So they could spend all these years and then end up with no regulation whatsoever because the agency remands it. I'm not saying this would never happen, but if we try to write this statute saying that the threshold is zero, that all regulations are going to get reviewed, it's never going to get enacted, and then we're down. So it's a question of, as I said before, whether we're going to allow the excellent to defeat the good.
We still have two questions pending at this point. Let me ask about the likelihood of passage of this, if anybody wants to comment on that. This is something that has been talked about for some time as a refinement, I guess, of the Congressional Review Act or revisiting it. Do either of you want to speak to that, next steps forward and the likelihood of this moving?
Yeah, we saw last Congress where it passed the House and didn't get a hearing in the Senate. It's passed the House this Congress, and during the budget voterama, as they call it, I know Senator Paul had offered it as an amendment, but I don't believe it ever came up for a vote. They just have it a little trickier over there with Harry Reid in charge. Earlier this summer, there was some talk, I think Politico and maybe some other papers, mentioned that House leadership was considering adding the Reins Amendment as a negotiating position on a debt limit debate. I don't know where we're at with that right now, but that would probably be the best chance of passage in this Congress. I just don't see the Senate taking it up. Beyond that, though, the House has vetted it now twice, and should we get control of the Senate next Congress on the Republican side, I think the chances go way up. At that point, it would be up to the president. So we're optimistic that, if not this Congress, which is probably a little more unlikely, that in the future, at least, we've got some momentum behind it.
Very good. Let's take another call.
Yeah, hi. This is Darren Bax from the Heritage Foundation. A couple of questions that are from the critics. the number of rules that would that Congress would consider, even though they wouldn't have many rules, is still the assumption would be that it's unrealistic for Congress to affirmatively take action, given the gridlock that exists in Congress. And then the second question that I have connected to that is, if one Congress passes a law and the next Congress essentially would be able to, by not taking any action, effectively deny implementation of that previous law without actually passing a law that, you know, expressly preempts the previous law that was passed in the Congress, previous Congress. So just one of your thoughts on those two questions, two criticisms.
Trevor and Emily, do you want to talk about why there would have to be votes?
The bill lays out, an expedited timeline. There's no filibuster capability within the Senate. It must be done within 70 days. Expedited approval sent out of committee if they don't take action directly to the floor, and if it doesn't get done, it's not enacted. So, I think, while the messaging has become more anti-regulation, at the same, we've been taking the more accountability route, and we don't believe all regulations are bad. There will be a referendum on folks to get a regulation implemented. So I don't really see how congressmen will be able to just do nothing on a lot of these and not see some kind of pushback on it.
Yeah, and I think to both that point and to your second question, I guess a lot of it depends because, again, the ability to write regulations in the executive branch comes from individual laws in the legislature. So really, I think it depends on the popularity of the law in question when you're talking about future Congresses. If it's a popular law and the House or the Senate refuses to take anything up, then I think there's a public backlash there, which is why we want to shift that accountability over to Congress. On the flip side, if it's something like an Obamacare or Dodd-Frank, which aren't real popular, so much so that it costs Democrats their majority in the House, then I think there's public backing to scrutinize those regulations that came out of a law in a previous Congress. So I think the role of congressional accountability and public backlash can't be stated enough is why we need the RAINS Act.
The actual design of the statute, when I recommended the design of the statute to J.D. Hayworth, I based it on some proposals for fast-track legislation by Stephen Breyer. It's basically like the base closing. They just have to vote on it. They can't avoid it. And if you're going to vote against a regulation that has popular support, you're going to pay a price in the next election. And there's really a deeper, more principled reason why something like the RAINS Act is right. Let me read you a quote from Bruce Ackerman, who, as you all know, is a prominent, very prominent liberal law professor. And this is what he wrote. In America, it is not enough to be right. Before you can impose your views on the polity, you have to convince your fellow citizens that you're right. That's what democracy is all about. So it makes good sense to require the president to gain the support of Congress, even when his vision is morally compelling. He should not be allowed to lead the nation on a great leap forward through executive decree. And that includes by executive decisions to make regulations.
We have one caller question pending. If you want to, and then our lines are open, push the star button and then the pound button if you have a question you'd like to ask. Let's go to our next caller.
Hi, this is Brian Mannix at the GW Regulatory Studies Center. I wanted to ask another question, another aspect of judicial review, and I think Chris DeMuth in a National Affairs article stated this best. He said, if a rule were approved, passed by majorities of both houses and signed by the president, no court would hold that it was arbitrary or capricious, an abuse of discretion, not in accord with the agency's authorizing statutes, or insufficiently justified by a demonstration of benefits and costs. courts would rightly treat such rules as statutory law and invalidate them only on constitutional grounds, it would be helpful if proponents acknowledge this reality. Do you think that's true? Or what's the argument that courts would still feel free to overturn a congressionally approved rule?
Well, Christian Muth is always right. I mean, I'm being perfectly. I mean, but maybe he exaggerates a little bit. I think Chris is absolutely right that it would be highly unlikely, though not impossible, that a court would say that a rule that Congress approved was arbitrary and capricious. On the other hand, think about the scope of the agency's authority. Let's say that the agency has authority to regulate air pollution but doesn't have authority to regulate water pollution, and the agency under its air pollution authority adopts a water pollution regulation and Congress approves it. Well, I think in those circumstances, I think I could well see the court a court striking the regulation as beyond the agency's authority. And I think that's a reason why there ought to be, you know, why I'm sympathetic with the judicial review provision of the statute, which maintains judicial review. I mean, as a matter of principle, I agree with Chris that, you know, we ought to have accountability one way or the other. It ought to be legislative accountability where elected lawmakers vote for the law, or you have a court reviewing the thing. But why do you need both? Isn't it confusing to have both? On the other hand, there's a risk here to Congress that agencies could extend their own authority by sending over to Congress a regulation that's beyond their authority to adopt. And so it seems to me, at least on the issue of the scope of the agency's authority, there's an argument for why there ought to be some kind of judicial review.
Well, that raises an interesting point. If the agencies do try to overreach and count the votes and get something enacted that they didn't originally have the authority for, would a court feel free to strike that down?
I think if it's clearly beyond the agency's authority under the organic statute that the agency is operating under, I think the court would.
Okay.
But I mean, I think we often have close questions. I think that at the margin, the fact that Congress voted for the thing would help to resolve a close statutory question in favor of the agency. But I think it's a marginal impact. But I think that the impact on the arbitrary and capricious type of issue would be very, very big.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
We've got another caller question.
Yeah, it seems that the solution to this, of course, is more legislation that would have to be passed. It also comes from downsized D.C., which would be the Read the Bills Act, which would force each bill to be read on the floor of Congress, that would give people the ability to know what's in a 3,000-page bill. And then the other part of it is give at least 3 weeks after a bill is finalized so that before it's voted on, so that you can't sneak in a 3,000-page bill overnight and force it to be passed. And then Nancy Pelosi says, well, we don't know what's in it. We have to pass it first.
I think part of the problem, though, is even when you have a 2,000 or 3,000-page bill, when it's as vague as something like Obamacare was, there's still a lot of room. So whether you read that on the floor or not, when you're purposely delegating that much responsibility to HHS and these other agencies, you're reading the bill, I guess, doesn't necessarily get at the heart of that. I'd also say I think that at least on the House side, the last couple of Congresses we've worked since Republicans took over to implement more of those transparency measures and requiring bills to be posted online several days in advance and so on. So there's definitely a need for more of that. But it's the actual underlying legislation itself that delegates the authority to the agencies that we need to get at. So if Congress knows it's coming back to our doorstep anyways, under something like the RAINS Act, and I think that gets at a lot of that ambiguous language that currently is introduced currently.
Downsize DC has another approach there. It's called one subject at a time, which is don't put a 3,000 page bill out there. Do a bill that only covers one subject, and don't try to load it up with a lot of stuff that has nothing to do with it.
Have another question from the audience, so let's go to our next caller.
Yeah, hi, this is Darren back from the Heritage Foundation again. A quick question. I know that the $100 million is the kind of the trigger number. Well, actually, I guess that amendment for $50 million would be the trigger, which may be too low. I'm wondering whether or not other types of triggers have been considered, instead of the $100 million. If I remember in previous versions of RAINS Act, and maybe even this version, like if an issue was novel in nature, that might be something that would trigger it. You can maybe imagine a scenario where a $100 million rule, in fact, it is $100 million, may be completely less discretionary in nature for the agency, and actually may have less of an impact, in a sense, than even a less costly rule that might be far more novel and actually be more suitable for congressional approval. So can you envision other triggers that might work better or have been considered?
I think the advantage of the $100 million, the major regulation definition is that it has been used for many, many years at the Office of Management and Budget. And that history is going to help courts determine whether agencies have tried to pull a fast one by getting underneath the trigger. And I think to the extent we try to throw in stuff like novelty and so on and so forth, well, I mean, how novel is novel? You know, then you have a great deal of difficulty judging what fits in and what fits out. And as I said before, at this point, we're at going 0 miles per hour on accountability. Let's get going, and I think we have a better chance of passing the bill if we stick with an established definition. See how it works. Maybe we'll have a better idea down the road, but let's get some experience. Let's get the bill. Let's get a bill passed, and then we can figure out about how to get the perfect bill passed.
No, I agree. The problem with the novel is too subjective of a term. I appreciate it. Thanks.
Yeah, and I would say we would be open to discussing other triggers, but part of the problem is in discussing these things is that they start to look a little more difficult to achieve when you try and put them in the legislative form, and it can also complicate things as you're trying to count the votes. So, we've adopted that $100 million threshold in the RAINS Act because, like David said, it's already OMB's own measuring stick. So it makes the bill a little cleaner, and it makes it tougher to oppose the bill when it's already a well-recognized designation.
Who actually makes the $100 million designation for RAINS Act purposes?
That's the Office of Management and Budget.
Okay. I mean, I think an objective bright line number like $100 million makes a lot of sense. The only concern has been addressed over and over is the potential for gaming, but you do have to start somewhere. So,
well, we are just about out of time, and it looks like we're out of questions. But before we adjourn, we do have a couple minutes. Let me give an opportunity to each of our experts to fill in any gaps they think they've left or express any final thoughts. And why don't we go in the same order we began with Trevor Foudy and Emily Mueller. Take a minute or two to augment anything you said earlier.
I would just say thanks to everybody that participated, and thanks for the great questions. The challenge this Congress and in the future is always going to be the Senate. So to the extent that this is something you agree with, if you can reach out to folks over in the Senate and help Rand Paul. I know Mike Lee, I believe, has also been involved in working with Senator Paul on this. So they need your help over there. And don't ever hesitate to reach out to our office with ideas on RAINS Act or other regulatory accountability issues.
Emily Mueller, any final thoughts before we turn to Professor Sean Broad?
No, same thing. You know, it's an issue the boss really latched onto when he first got here, so we're welcome to any other suggestions you all have on this bill or otherwise.
All right. Well, actually, before we turn to you, Professor, it looks like we do have one more question. If you don't mind, we'll take the time to take this final question.
Yes, I'm just sort of joining the party now, and I see that you're closing down. Can you tell me how we can track this bill to see how it moves along?
Trevor or Emily?
Yeah, we have a website at toddyoung.house.gov/reins. That's R-E-I-N-S. We've got a list of co-sponsors in both the House and Senate. Whenever other members write opinion pieces or there are news articles about it, we put those up. And you can also get the legislative text there as well. That's also got information on the Senate bill introduced by Senator Paul. So I think just using that as a resource, and then Thomas, the Library of Congress's legislative tracking tool is always a good option as well.
Great, thank you.
All right, Professor, before we adjourn, your final thoughts?
Yeah, I think that Congressman Young and his staff are doing a terrific job on this matter. And what I really like about what they're doing is they're keeping the focus on accountability. We have a lot of stupid regulations, but we have a lot broader support for the idea that we ought to have a democracy than support for the idea that any particular regulation is good or bad. So I think as long as we keep the focus on accountability, we're going to eventually win.
Well, on behalf of the Federalist Society, I want to thank all of our experts, Emily Mueller, Trevor Foudy, and Professor Dave Schoenbrod, for joining us today and for your insights. To the audience, we don't have a next scheduled telephone conference call to announce later this week, but we have a pretty busy week planned next week. There is also a possibility that we'll add a telephone call either tomorrow or Friday if we can get it in place, and that would address the constitutionality of presidential action in Syria. We're looking to put together a debate on that. Early next week, on Tuesday and Wednesday, we do have two telephone conference calls scheduled, one on Tuesday on mandatory minimums and one on Wednesday looking at some antitrust issues. But until then, we are adjourned. Thank you very much, everyone. Thank you for listening. We hope you enjoyed this Practice Group podcast. For materials related to this podcast and other Federalist Society multimedia, please visit the Federalist Society's website at federalistsociety.org/multimedia.